6 months, Hall's van was spotted by more than 11 girls in 5 different towns close by.
Welcome back to another episode of 7 Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening, and thank you for the birthday wishes yesterday. You are friends from afar, and I love you. I really appreciate it. That was pretty cool. So, I'd like to start today's episode off with a short tribute to the late Ray Liotta. You see, my husband Greg had the opportunity to work with Ray a couple years back on a documentary you must see. I'm telling you, called Syndrome K. It's a true story of Italian doctors who made up a fake disease during Hitler's awful reign to save Jewish people in their community from being taken to the camps. And they made the disease sound so unappealing to the soldiers that when they came to raid the hospital, they were too afraid to even enter the room with the almost leper-like patients who were not sick at all. Thus, saving several lives. It's truly an incredible story. And Ray Liotta was kind enough to do the voiceover for the film and is likely the main reason why I responded to an email from the PR team behind the new show Blackbird, requesting that I interview the showrunner, Dennis Lahan. So hear me out, I'm not so cool or so busy that I wouldn't respond to such a request. It's just that I was unsure if they thought they were emailing me regarding my old podcast, Be Here for a While, that was strictly interview-based, or if they knew that this was a true crime story / research podcast. So I was sort of busy and indifferent. But I responded, and thank God I did, because not only do I get to mention Greg's work with Ray Liotta and watch his final role with his amazing portrayal of the real-life Big Jimmy Keene. But I also learned of one of the most chilling, widely unknown serial killers to date. This is the case of Larry Dwayne Hall and his multiple beautiful victims who have still yet to be found. But what is this guy's sin? I mean, he's kind of sinned all over the map. But I would say sloth. That hits the nail on the head the most to me. If you even watch one frame of the scripted show Blackbird and see the way the actor, Paul Walter Hauser, moves about the room emulating the real-life version of Larry D. Hall, you'll probably agree. The real Larry Dwayne Hall was so sloth-like in his every move that he was too lazy to stand for anything that technically wasn't himself. Some who have reported on the 7 deadly sins consider the most accurate translation of acidia, another word used for sloth, to be, quote, self-pity, for it, quote, conveys both the melancholy of the condition and self-centeredness upon which it is founded, end quote. Sure, Larry admittedly had a terrible childhood and a first go at life, but he was so pathetically self-centered in his self-loathing that in later years, I find it hard to feel bad for him. He was more of a con than a victim, a monster, instead of the delicate soul many, even professional career people like psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors, law enforcement, felt the need to shield and protect him. Some saw him as a gentle giant who just wanted to fit in, not capable of the horrendous, heartbreaking crimes he admitted to committing. But thankfully, those opinions finally skewed on the side of guilt, as Larry Hall will spend the rest of his life in prison. And I intend to write that man a letter and see what I can extract from his sinister mind.
Hello. You have reached FCI2 in Butner, North Carolina. If you know your part is extension, you can dial it at any time. If this call is in reference to an inmate, press 0 or stay on the line. Thank you.
Please hold, and I'll get someone to assist you.
FCI2 Butner.
Hello.
Hi. I was wondering, I mean, I don't know how this works, and I hopefully I'm not being offensive or doing the wrong protocol, but I was wondering if an inmate by the name of Larry Dwayne Hall was located there.
You said Hall?
Hall, yeah, H-A-L-L, last name, Larry, first name.
Let me see.
Thank you.
Do you have his registration number?
I don't. I can probably find it online, but no, I don't right now.
Okay, I need that to identify if he's here or not.
Okay, I'll find it and give you a call back.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
FCI to Butner.
Hi. I just called a little bit earlier. I do have the registration number now for Larry Dwayne Hall.
Okay.
It is 10332.
Yes, ma'am. He's here.
He's here? Okay. Does he accept calls, visitors, mail, anything?
He is in a regular unit, so you can't call him. He has to call you. But he can get mail.
In later years, even Larry's own twin brother, who was his biggest ally, has changed his tune. He knows now that his brother is an absolute monster and has publicly spoken about it via a CNN documentary.
Larry, just like Jimmy King calls him, and he's a baby killer.
You think your brother is a baby killer?
I don't have no doubt in my mind.
Do you think your brother killed more than Jessica Roach?
Yes.
Do you think your brother killed Trisha Reitler?
Yes.
Raina Ryson? Michelle Dewey?
Yes. I went with the Indianapolis detectives down to try to get my brother to confess. He made me leave the room. He did, in fact, confess on tape to 15 serial murders.
Larry later retracted again. So who is Larry Dwayne Hall? Well, he was born on December 11th, 1962, in Wabash, Indiana, at the same time as his twin brother, Gary. Gary somehow sucked up most of the nutrients in the womb, in addition to oxygen, and Larry was born blue, from lack of oxygen. But his lack of basic human needs and nourishment didn't end there. Larry and Gary were born into an abusive and dysfunctional household. His dad drank too much and took his aggressions out on the entire family. His mom was overbearing, a tad reminiscent of fellow serial killer Ed Gein. She babied and controlled her boys, specifically Larry, but she was also submissive to her abusive alcoholic husband. His mother, Aria Bernice Hall, was a stay-at-home mom, and his father, Robert R. Hall, worked as a local gravedigger at the local cemetery in Wabash, Indiana. He was a former World War II Navy member and veteran, and he moved his family onto the cemetery grounds in a small, disorganized, clutter-filled, filthy house. They were living so far below the average means to survive that Larry again suffered nutritional deficiencies, as there wasn't enough food to go around. As early as kindergarten, too, Larry began displaying antisocial personality issues. By his own account, and from the mouth of Gary, his brother, Gary is able to make friends easy, got average grades in school, had a girlfriend, and in the simplest of terms, kind of thrived. Larry, on the other hand, was stated to have had an IQ of just 80, and in Gary's words from the CNN documentary on Hall said,
What was it like growing up next to a cemetery? Was it creepy?
No, not at all. Not for me. You know, at 12 years of age, Larry and I started working at the cemetery. He was always the backward twin. I was the more dominant, outgoing twin. He hung out with what my wife and I and a lot of fellow classmates called the misfits or the stinky crowd.
But here's the thing. I'm not buying this lower intelligence thing. Possibly when it came to maybe book smarts or social smarts, maybe Larry lacked, but he was smart enough to pull off being a serial killer for over a decade, and still only one victim has been found. But his upbringing was a recipe for disaster. He was bullied by the other children for his low IQ and for having a speech impediment. Additionally, Larry was also still wetting the bed at about 5 years old and, frankly, later than that. And he claimed to be plagued by terrible nightmares. And the twins were also made fun of in school because of the bizarre nature of them living in a cemetery. Despite Gary's claims that their dysfunctional home life didn't make Larry's mental health any worse, and possibly due to the abuse they suffered at the hands of their father, allegedly one night, while the family was eating dinner, their dad began choking at the dinner table, and both boys just sat there and went on eating and shrugged it off and said, "Maybe it would be better if he died anyway." Even if his dad was abusive, that lack of emotion is chilling. Larry was also known to be cruel to animals and set a few fires in the Indiana area. Dark triad, whether true or not these days, it is important to note that he does check all of those boxes. And because Gary, his brother, saw himself more as a confident, you know, the light, easy, breezy one. He was dominant. And he would guide Larry's behavior growing up. So Larry did everything that Gary told him. They were as thick as thieves. And they eventually went headfirst into doing Civil War reenactments. They emulated the style of the hair and the beards and the clothing of the time. Hence, Larry's Burnsides or mutton chops. They're sideburns. Or mutton chops, but he will correct everyone saying Burnsides, also influenced Larry's view on life. So he emulated being a part of the Civil War time, which influenced the fact that he thought marrying a 12-year-old girl was fine. In Civil War times, he said there were brides as young as 13, or 12, 13, 14, and Larry likely used this mentality to justify his attraction and gruesome crimes towards girls of that age. Larry wanted to have a girlfriend so badly, but girls and women were just turned off by him. Something in their gut likely told them this man is unsafe. And this rejection, according to Larry, spurred him to start having quote-unquote urges. These nearly uncontrollable urges sought him to seek therapy in his late teens, but that didn't stick. His therapy was Civil War reenactments, a transient lifestyle, and self-loathing murder. Traveling for the Civil War reenactments was the first time Larry felt outgoing and charming a bit. He was away from his small hometown and he could be himself. But still, girls weren't knocking at his door. But somehow, he managed to get them into his van, usually on the pretense of help, a ride, or by sheer force. Now, I hadn't planned on what's coming next. I had been researching this case for weeks, and I came across a Facebook page from a man that wrote a book about Jimmy Keen, which you'll hear about later, probably next episode, and Larry Hall. And he had speculated that there was possibly a accomplice in this whole thing. And I got to be honest, I kind of thought maybe his brother was an accomplice, because if Larry is to be believed to be as dopey as they claim, which I'm not buying it for a second at this point, it seems like maybe he needed help. Because if he murdered as many women as they think upwards of maybe even 50, you have to be smart enough to figure out how to hide those bodies. So in this research, I come across his Facebook page, see that this guy said that there was probably an accomplice. And then I see a comment below from Jessica Roach's mother, Terry Roach, which Jessica Roach was the tipping point to spurn this whole investigation. She was the only body found of all these women, and her mother, Terry, commented that she through and through does not believe there was an accomplice, and you'll hear her say it in her own words. And I had thought about it for a week or so. I was like, don't reach out to her, don't reach out to her, like, she's been through enough, don't do it. And then, like a psycho, today when I was supposed to record, I reached out to her. But we had the most lovely 3-hour conversation. And I stand by her and I love her. I think she's funny, beautiful, cool. And I just want you to know from her words who her daughter was.
So I wanted to ask you what, you know, just your truth.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, because I just yesterday, I think it was, found out that they actually are going to have that program about Jimmy Keen. When we did, because we actually did an interview for Dateline, and it was all about the Jimmy Keen story, and they were saying that he wanted to do a program, a movie and everything, and this is the first I'd heard about it. It was one of the girls that Larry Hall followed from Georgetown after while he was still missing, or while he was still, hadn't been arrested or anything. I saw it on her Facebook, and I didn't even know anything about it.
Well, can I tell you something?
Yes.
I hope that you like it as much as, and there is an entire episode dedicated to your daughter. I thought it was beautifully done. It's going to make me cry that you haven't seen it yet, because that's your daughter. And I hope that it depicts her in the way that, it makes me emotional because it was such a beautiful episode. I really, really hope they do it justice. Why do you believe that there was not an accomplice? Because that went to my brain at first when they were saying, like, he had such a low IQ. But first of all, he did not seem like a dummy. He was good at certain things. Yes. Like, maybe he wasn't great at school, but he was good at other things.
Yes.
I thought possibly his brother could have been an accomplice.
I can tell you, we were very much part of any of the investigation and the stuff that was going on. And the reason we were is because they talked to us early on in the investigation and said, if you want to be a part of this, you cannot tell anybody what we talk about. And we didn't. We didn't go on TV. We didn't do all of these different things. You know, we didn't talk to family members about what they were talking to or questioning us about or talking to us about. And in those conversations, did they investigate his brother? Absolutely. They really did. Did they investigate others who claimed to have, that actually confessed? Yes. Did they investigate other incidents where maybe there was some linkage? Yes. Did they find anything to say to where they would have said there was anybody else involved? No. Mm. If there had been anyone questionable enough, we would have known about it. I have no doubt that he was, he did this on his own. I can't believe that they would have left that you know, wouldn't have pursued it, you know?
Yeah.
I really don't think, and we would have known. I really mm-hmm. think that because we were such, even during the, because we did go through two trials. During the trial, mm-hmm. we went up, they had us go up to the prosecutor's office during breaks. We heard the conversations. We were a part of that whole thing, you know. I even walked away with one of the FBI guys' mugs, coffee mugs, because they gave it to me. you know, we knew. They said things to, like, we were sitting in there, and Larry Beaumont would say to me, "What do you think the jury's thinking? I can't watch their faces. What do you think?" I mean, we were that involved in the whole process.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was that re-traumatizing to, well, two trials, but also to have to be that involved, or did it help you sort of feel like you were doing something, you know, because you're obviously feeling helpless. I mean, what can you really do except for what you did? But was it re-traumatizing?
No. Actually, the more involved I felt, like the more involved we were, the more times I talked about it, the better and better it became. Now, I'm not going to lie to you. When it becomes personal, like, tell me about Jesse, tell me that, then I'll cry. I'm not going to lie. That will do it. But talking about the process, talking about what happened, you know, I can do that. Just don't ask, you know, don't expect me not to get weepy if you ask me questions about Jesse personally. Because that's
Well, now I know you've informed me, but I get that. I don't mind if you do cry. I mean, I cried over your daughter about a minute into this call. So
I heard you.
So don't be embarrassed. But I get that sentiment of, like, if you're kind of doing something, moving forward to kind of, like, honor her, like, or to get justice for her, that's easier than talking about what a beautiful girl she was.
Informing people that this happens. It happens to people you know. Just because
mm-hmm.
you see it on TV, we have a tendency, I can tell you, that when the very first time they showed the missing person alert on TV, because Jesse was missing for 6 weeks, I remember sitting there thinking, I have seen these all, so many times, and you think to yourself, oh, that's so sad, and she's so pretty, and the commercial goes off, your program comes back on, and you don't think about it again. And I remember
mm-hmm.
thinking, oh, somebody's doing that about my daughter. Until it becomes a personal thing, a lot of times I think that's what happens. I know that when we were still looking for Jesse, and I had moved to Springfield, or I had transferred, my job transferred me to Springfield. I was managing the Pearle Vision there in Springfield.
Mm-hmm.
And I had flyers, missing person flyers, and I've had it on the front door of my store. And this gentleman comes in to pick up his glasses, and he sees the flyer. He asks me, and I told him, you know, this is my daughter, we're still looking for her, blah, blah, blah. And he asked me, he says, I teach fifth grade. Do you have any more of these flyers? And I said, yeah. He said, I'm going to take these to my kids. I want them to pass them out because kids have terminal immortality.
Mm-hmm.
And they need
wow.
to know that this can happen. Yeah.
Wow.
Terminal immortality. Isn't that true? You know?
Absolutely.
They think that nothing will ever happen to them. And that, to me, was one of the most important messages that I wanted people to get, because I want parents to think, you know what, this can happen to my kids. Jesse was 15. Why do we allow 3- and 4-year-olds to walk away from us in supermarkets or at K's, you know, at Sam's Club kind of places? We were at Sam's Club doing one of these little, where we were informing people and passing out information how to protect your kids and stuff. And I look over and here's this little girl. She was probably about 4 or 5 years old. And I don't see any parents around. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh. So I'm watching her. And I step over just far enough, close enough to her that she can hear me. And I said, have you lost your mommy? And she says, no, she's over there. And she points. And I said, well, why don't we go find her? So we start walking. I am on one side of Sam's Club in Champaign. Her parents were on the complete other side by the other set of doors with 3 other little kids. So we get over there. Yeah. And the little girl walks up to her dad, and he's patting her on the shoulder, you know. And I said, is this your little girl? And the mother said, she says, yes. I said, well, she was all the way on the other side of the store. And this mother said to me, and nobody took her?
What?
I was, yes. I just looked at her, and this makes me very emotional. And I said, my daughter was Jessica Roach. And the father took that little girl and just pulled him up close to his leg and just looked at me. And the mom's just kind of looking at me with this look like, yeah. And I turned and walked away. I was ready to cry.
Oh my God, you're gonna make me cry.
It makes me very emotional right now. That she could say that and in such a flippant way. You know? Yeah. Yeah. I have people, I actually had about 2 weeks ago a lady that I had talked to over a year ago in the Target Optical in Springfield. I was managing there, and she had come in and to, I don't know whether she was picked up glasses, I don't even care. But anyway, she came in the store, and her daughter was probably about 13, and she kept wanting to go out into the store, and her mom said, no, you're just going to have to wait until I'm done. And the little girl walked away, and I very quietly, because I didn't want to say anything in front of the kids, I thanked her and told her, I think, you know, I'm really glad that you are not letting her go like that. And I told her why, and I told her about Jessie. This lady came in the store probably a couple weeks ago, and reminded me. So I know that if one person that I talk to takes that to heart.
Did he admit it in court?
He admitted, okay, let me try and back up there. His confession was read in court. And when he was on the stand, because the defense that they were putting up was that it was a dream he had. It didn't really happen. And that's how they were trying to. But when he was on the stand, he admitted to chasing every one of the girls from the time of Jesse's death, disappearance and death, until he was arrested. He admitted to every one of those girls. And then he looked straight at us in the courtroom and said that he didn't do anything to Jesse.
What?
You know. Yeah.
Really?
Because they... Right. That was in the very first trial that we had. When the first conviction that went down. He was on the stand, I do not know how many hours, with the prosecutor questioning him and everything, and he never got him to to say anything that Larry didn't want to say. But we were sitting there, and he said that, I mean, during all these questions, he answered yes. He chased those girls, yes. He knew, and then he looked straight at us in the courtroom and said, but he didn't do anything to Jessica. So he knew exactly who we were. No, I didn't believe him at all. I believe he chased those other girls, yes. But no.
Do you believe that he didn't do anything to Jesse?
No, I absolutely do not believe. I know he did it to Jesse. And he said he acted just the same. He apparently said he thinks he had sex with her. He didn't talk about at that time in the confession, he didn't talk about hitting her. They know that he used starter fluid. But during the first trial, they had the forensic pathologist was on the stand, and he said that they found a fracture in her jaw that where he had hit her so hard that he broke her jaw. Nobody knew that. We didn't know it until we were sitting in the courtroom and heard it.
What did that feel like to hear that? That's horrible.
It's
your baby. That's horrible.
Yeah, it's very surreal. I mean, you hear that and you think, but it explained how he got her to let go of the bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
My husband saw the drag marks from the bicycle in the road. And I knew that, it made perfect sense as to how he got her to let go of the bicycle.
So do you think that the flat tire was a fake thing in the
Yeah.
Did she not have a flat?
No, she did not have a flat. Here's what happened. We lived in the country. We lived not on just any country road. This was a single lane dirt road. It had river rock. When the kids were young, if they wanted to, at first I wouldn't let them ride on the road. No, you're not riding in the road. You're not going to do it. But after a while, we decided, okay, they were older. You can ride your bike up the road and back. But if there's a car coming, you need to stop and get off and walk your bike or stop and wait till they pass. They don't need to be worried about you falling in front of them. So when a car comes, you stop the bike, get off and walk. She had gotten off her bike and was walking back because the first car she saw was my oldest daughter that passed her going to town. In less than 3 minutes from when Mindy saw Jesse on the road, the school bus came by and Jesse's bike was in the road. 3 minutes. So Larry Hall, yes, less than 3 minutes. They with the times and everything for the school bus and everything, it was about a 3 minute time span. So Larry Hall was probably coming up behind Mindy, a fair enough piece, that because she did not see anybody behind her, but Jessie was walking her bike, not riding it. She was walking. And that's when he came up and stopped to talk to her. He also said in his confession that he asked her if she wanted to go for a ride, and she saw the handlebars in his van and said, well, it looks like you're ready, or something to that effect. And she said, no. And he said, in his confession, he said he knew she wasn't going to come with him, and that's when he grabbed her.
So, yeah, he changes his story a ton then.
Yes. Yes.
See, and that's
but
also
basic,
why I don't think he's a dummy.
No. Did you also notice he never once said anything about anybody being with him?
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that now. I only, just putting it all together, and is when they say he has an IQ of 80, and then, but his brother's dopey as shit, too, so I don't really know how the two of them together, even though they say that he was the more dominant twin, but if you watch him speak, it's like, I don't really see how he's any better than Larry, but he does seem more moral.
Because his wife at the time, during the trial, it was on one of the breaks, or something, I don't remember exactly how it was, but his wife came up to me and apologized.
Really? Oh.
And then, of course.
So Gary's wife apologizes to you.
Yeah, she came and apologized. She started to say something more, and she was ushered away by the powers that be, let's call them, you know, the different ones that were basically watching out for us. You know, said, no.
Wow.
And, during
the
first
trial... Did you
find
them to be nice people? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I didn't really talk to them any at all. That was the only interaction there was. I know that, but during the first trial, his father fabricated evidence to try to give him an alibi, and his brother tried to give him an alibi saying he was not in the area on September 20th, and it was all found to be, I mean, they literally found proof that his dad had fabricated a receipt and brought the owner of the salvage yard to court with receipts and everything showing that it wasn't true. They didn't even bring those things into the second trial because what was the point? It was already proven to be lies.
Wow.